Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
Good morning. You are tuned in now to CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is a very special day here at CITR. 24 hours of student power. We're going to start things off with a track from, or not a track, a podcast from the LFS Land and Food Systems Faculty audio storytelling class. So I hope you enjoy it.
Instructors for a course here at UBC called LFS 400. It's a course in the Faculty of Land and Food Systems that has agriculture students learn how to create radio documentaries, audio stories, podcasts, that kind of stuff. For the next hour or so, we're going to listen to a whole bunch of different stories created by UBC students playing it as a part of 24 hours of student power. I hope you enjoy them. Thank you.
I grew up on the outskirts of Winnipeg. My father hunted, my family hunted. At about probably 8 or 10 years of age, I ran a trap line. I went out, basically snared, trapped, shot rabbits, brought them home. My mom cooked them. We grew up with, for example, we had a chicken house. The early realization was if you wanted to eat a chicken, chicken had to die. And the reality was somebody had to kill it. So what we've got now is a situation where most people don't relate, the animal to the meat. We get people who think that meat comes in plastic packages and, no animals were harmed during this process. The reality is that, it happens. And if you want to eat meat, or I guess even if you want to eat a vegetable, something has to die.
That voice? That's Marshall Owen. Marshall taught me firearm safety and hunting education. He's great. He has a lifetime of experience and a deep, thoughtful connection with hunting. But from my voice, you might be asking, why does she want to hunt? And you're right, I don't really match the demographic. I'm a 20-something university student. I live in Vancouver. I grew up in the suburbs. I was the only girl present the day I wrote the firearm safety exam. When I started this project, I had never killed an animal. That's changed now, and you'll hear about it a little later. I'm telling you up front because I don't think it's fair to spring that on someone in the middle of a podcast. But I'll also tell you that it's fine. It wasn't traumatic for me or for the animal or for anyone involved. I'm interested in the disconnect that Marshall was talking about, how we don't relate the meat to the animal. So many of us consume meat without any thought towards the life that gave it. I want to eat meat, but I want to be connected to where it comes from. And most of the meat produced on this planet comes from a pretty bleak place.
Most Canadians and Americans eat about, or at least you could say, half a pound of meat a day, which is far more than the planet seems to be able to.
Then they look at contaminated meat. Well, maybe we can pass it through because we've got to make a buck on it. So what do you know about the animal you just ate?
And it's something that that we will continue to be supporting as long as we insist on having meat virtually every meal, and more importantly, as long as we insist that it be cheap. If the meat that you find at your local store is inexpensive, it was probably produced in a factory farm, and it probably came from animals that didn't have much of a life.
Well, we have to stop and think about what happens to our wastewater. The mass majority of people flush the toilet, use the laundry, have a shower, and don't give a moment's thought to what's going down the drain and where it's ending up.
Hi there. My name is Dylan Rolick, and I'm going to take you through an audio journey of Vancouver's wastewater systems, talking about the pros, cons, upgrades, and future alternatives. The following is meant to be an instructional, informative, and useful broadcast to help make our water ecosystems a little bit better, and for us to be smarter citizens. To do this, I have educated myself and had interviews with Georgia Strait Alliance's Christiane Willemsen and Metro Vancouver's wastewater process supervisor, Brian Heistad. I hope you enjoy. So to start off with, we all need a common definition of wastewater. Simply put, it's all of the water and the stuff inside of it that you use in your house, commercial venues, and industrial sources. You flush it down the drain, and it goes through piping. In Metro Vancouver, there is more than 15,000 kilometers of pipes just to get wastewater to its destination. That's the equivalent of driving across the country and back just to cross it again. All this wastewater reaches one of the five different treatment plants spread out through Metro Vancouver. Brian Heistad explains the process of treatment after reaching this destination.
The two plants that are discharging to salt water are primary treatment plants only. Primary treatment is basically a settling process where the wastewater is put into a large tank, given a period of quiescence. Sludge is removed from the bottom and the scum is removed from the top, and the stuff is released from that point. At Lion's Gate, the effluent is chlorinated and dechlorinated, and Iona goes to a deep sea outfall.
Why do you have it to different levels at different areas?
Because it was felt at the time that secondary treatment wasn't required for ocean discharge.
Is that changing?
Yes, it is. There's a new Canadian standard that is asking for 25 milligrams per liter BOD and TSS as a minimum standard for all treatment plants in Canada. And we are moving to that standard.
What that federal standard means is that all the wastewater treatment plants will have to use what's called secondary treatment. So after the water has settled down during primary treatment and the heavy solids, sludge, and floating things, scum, are removed, bacteria get a chance to treat it further. Our wastewater is chock full of nutrients, mainly nitrogen and phosphorus. And just like our stomachs, these bacteria can break down the organic compounds to utilize these nutrients. The sludge and scum from the beginning and some of the bacteria are mixed together in digesters for about a month to turn it into a product similar to fertilizer itself. What this means is that we have the ability and knowledge to turn our poo into a useful resource.
The water that's coming out of the plants has very little toxins in it anymore. So that's the first thing, and that's going to happen because the new federal regulations that I refer to have as a minimum standard across Canada secondary treatment. So in a way, once those regulations become final, we will have achieved those, at least the first step. There's always a difference between regulations and implementation, but having seen Victoria's Liquid Waste Management Plan, Metro Vancouver's and Regional District of Nanaimo, they're all aiming for secondary. So we're well on our way to getting that. But the other thing we've been promoting probably for most of our existence, but definitely in the last 5-6 years, is changing our attitude about wastewater. Right now, the attitude is you create wastewater, you get rid of it, you treat it, and then you get rid of it. Well, what we've discovered, and communities around the world are discovering, is that sewage is actually a resource.
The goal is to create a closed-loop system with the most efficient processes as possible. These resource reclamation technologies include utilizing heat from sewage pipes themselves at the Olympic Village, turning solids into fertilizer, using the methane from the bacteria in the plants to heat the treatment plants themselves, and to continue cycling the naturally occurring bacteria. However, there are some impediments to universal implementation of such ideals of resource reclamation. One of these issues is the historical systems within Vancouver.
When Vancouver was built, they would combine wastewater and stormwater. And because the population was relatively small, that wasn't a big issue. But as we've grown, and certainly as the weather certainly gets wilder, basically when it rains, which it does a lot here, the volume of liquid can't be handled by the Iona plant. So again, most of Vancouver's sewage goes to Iona. So what happens is, because the plant can't handle the volume, what it does is it takes the sewage, combines it with the stormwater, and discharges it in a whole bunch of outputs all around Vancouver that discharged raw sewage into the ocean when the volume can't be handled by the treatment plant.
Fixing combined sewers is incredibly expensive, unfortunately. Quite often it's much cheaper to build a bigger plant than it is to fix that problem, because if there's an awful lot of pipes running under Vancouver.
Now, that's been recognized as a problem, and they certainly have cleaned up the worst ones. Clark Drive was one of the worst ones for discharge. It was just decimated, and so was False Creek. So what they are doing now, they unfortunately are on I think they have 39 more years to go. They're replacing the pipes at a rate of 1% per year. It's way too slow. I mean, that means for the next 39 years, we're still going to have raw sewage, diluted raw sewage, but still raw sewage nonetheless, going into our oceans and our rivers and our streams for quite some time. But it can be done faster. It's a question of political will.
The one limiting factor is always money.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, these plants are expensive. There's no question about it. The upgrade for Anisus and Lulu in the early 1990s was $500 million, which at the time we thought was an awful lot of money. They've just built a plant in Washington State now, the Brightwater plant. The cost has been closer to $1.5 billion, and that plant is about the size of our Lulu Island plant, so it's an expensive thing. And the newer the technologies are, it tends to be more expensive, so...
We can intuitively say that dumping raw sewage isn't good for the environment around us. So processes like the combined sewer system and the wear and tear of our 100-year lifespan pipes are crucial issues that must be addressed. It can easily be seen that our current challenge is to maintain current infrastructure and deal with the capacity demands of a growing region. This slows the progress towards the ecologically sound, more efficient technologies. The regional district develops our plans of action, currently entitled the Liquid Waste Management Plan, available online. Then the province manages the plants, all of which is done based on federal standards. All three levels of government pay for the upgrades through taxes, but the individual house owners themselves also play a role most remain oblivious towards.
Goes back to the fact that we haven't been replacing our pipes at a fast enough rate. So a lot of our pipes are cracked and stuff, but most of the pipes, when it comes to Metro Vancouver, belong to the individual homeowners.
Oh,
Metro
really?
Vancouver owns a small amount. The cities own a small amount, you know, because it's different ownership depending on, but the pipe from your house to the trunk line, which is out there, belongs to the homeowner. Well, how many homeowners do you know going, oh, I need to upgrade my sewage pipes? But there are some plans now, and it's in the new Liquid Waste Management Plan, to work with the real estate agents. So when someone buys a house, inspection of the pipeline will be part of it, and repairs to the pipeline will be part of the transfer. It's not going to be pretty, but it has to be done. I mean, the amount of sewage that's actually just seeping into our soil, you don't want to know.
There still remains the question of what makes our wastewater toxic, and when is it treated enough for the environment? It's easy to notice a giant island of floating plastic in the ocean and attribute a cause, but with wastewater, the toxins are invisible to the eye, and the effects may be hard to see. One of these is surfactant chemicals that are found in all soaps. These break down in the secondary treatment, but Vancouver's wastewater system still lacks this standard. The more soaps people use, the harder it is to break down the surfactants, and the higher chances of them killing fish. Another issue is human pathogens, but the secondary treatment process can also reduce these. Our pharmaceuticals are harder to treat, and we don't know the effects of them on the environment yet, especially when the pharmaceuticals mix to make new chemicals. Lastly, heavy metals are banned from our wastewater, but still show up from industrial sources now and then illegally. They are removed, but contaminate the solids, so that the solids can no longer be used as fertilizer. Now, we can all help relieve some of the stress on the system by reducing how much water we use. If we succeeded, upgrades could move towards reaching the higher standards of treatment and the newer technologies. It is hard, however, to imagine everyone changing their attitude and lifestyle choices. So instead, maybe think about what your impact is a little bit more. Do you care enough to talk to your politicians? Maybe check out some alternatives to the current system as well. UBC has the CK Choi building containing all compostable toilets, and the new CSRS building on campus will treat their wastewater on-site to better quality than rainwater. There are solutions. Wastewater doesn't have to be a problem and a toxin to our water ecosystem, but rather it can be incorporated into the system in a closed-loop, sustainable way. We now know that. All we have to do is support each other towards this mindset and try to make positive change. I'm Dylan Rolick, and I thank you for listening.
I swear, if I see a worm outside of that bin, I will throw it off the balcony.
Such was my sister's reaction when I told her we were getting a worm composting bin for our house, or more specifically, our living room. Needless to say, she was not impressed.
I feel like warmth plus rotten fruit plus creatures equals disgust. That's what I feel. Like, that is the perfect situation where the worms escape and attack because they're unhappy. Also, the smell, attracting flies.
My sister's horrified reaction towards this project was not surprising, given that I would be bringing worms into our home. But come 2015, Metro Vancouver will be banning all organic materials, including food scraps from the landfills, as part of their effort to reduce the equivalent weight in waste of almost 8.5 Empire State Buildings that Metro Vancouver produces every year. One suggestion for dealing with organic waste is vermicomposting, which is the process of recycling organic waste by feeding it to worms who then turn that waste into compost. So, my experiment will be to put a vermicompost in my apartment to see if it is a feasible option for reducing my family's waste. My only opposition? My sister, who is convinced that the worms will escape, that the compost will smell, and that Vancouver's ban on organic materials is one of the worst ideas she's ever heard. So in 2015, Vancouver will be banning all of its organic waste from landfills. So you can't put in any food scraps, you can't put any food scrapings in the garbage, any meat, any raw food products like vegetables and fruits. None of that from anywhere in Vancouver can go into the landfill anymore or into any of their waste facilities.
I feel like nobody knows about this. I've never heard about this before, and I think it's stupid.
Why do you feel this way? You seem to be very aggravated about this.
Like, what are you supposed to do with the food then? Why can't it just decompose in a landfill? Nobody's gonna do that. Nobody even recycles. Hell, I only recycle because of your judgmental gaze, okay?
So by sending organic waste to the landfill, we're actually producing more greenhouse gases. Because when it's trapped in a plastic bag, anaerobic decomposition happens. So what that means is that the bacteria that are breaking down the food in a non-oxygen environment, because it's stuck in a closed bag, produce methane. So this is one of the reasons why they're doing this, and also because you can divert some of that waste and then produce fertilizer in your own home.
So you really think 2.5 million people, most of which don't recycle, let's be honest here, are really going to go out and get a bin full of worms and put it in their home and start scraping off their food scrapings?
So worm compost isn't the only version of compost that you can use, but worm compost is good, especially for apartment dwellers who have limited space. In apartments, it's a little bit more challenging. So that's why I'm looking into a worm compost bin. So what are your initial thoughts on this worm compost bin now, especially that you know about the ban? I know you originally thought I just wanted them as pets.
The worm compost is probably the worst idea you've ever had, and you've had a few bad ones.
Why is it a bad idea?
Because you're bringing creatures into our house that will likely escape and attack me. And I don't want that to happen.
So, possibly those fears could be completely unfounded. The chances of a worm attack are quite limited.
Despite my sister's complete lack of enthusiasm, we were getting a worm compost. So, the following Saturday, I did a vermicomposting workshop offered by the City of Vancouver and took home a brand new worm bin. I also checked in with Emma, the vermicomposting coordinator in the UBC sub, who offered to take me down into the depths of the sub to see her healthy worm bin, and also to get some tips on managing my own.
I'm in the tunnels of the sub. Didn't even
know this existed. We're not in the most beautiful location just because, you know, this project came in considerably later than other things. So we kind of got relegated into the corner of this room.
Okay.
It's not the prettiest place, but.
This is huge.
So okay. This is called a worm wigwam.
A worm wigwam.
Yeah, we bought it from a supplier in Oregon.
I got half a pound of worms for my little worm composter at home.
Yeah.
So this is a much bigger...
We started with 10 and 10 pounds. 10 pounds of worms sort of was sitting in a substrate with a depth of maybe 6 or 8 inches.
Okay.
So I presume there's... a lot more than 10 pounds of worms now in this bin.
This is crazy.
So they're moving. You can see that they're healthy because they're wriggling around.
Yeah, and it doesn't really smell at all.
Nope.
That's crazy. So three of my sister's main fears are worm attacks.
Worm attacks?
Yes.
They
She's afraid that they'll leave the bin, that they'll escape. That's the second one. And the third one is that the compost will smell.
Okay. Yeah, it shouldn't smell, especially if you're burying it properly. And you're adding paper, right? So you have to add a lot of paper. And you make sure that the balance is right. So it's mostly balancing out. The two things that you're putting in are food scraps and paper. So if you balance out those two volumes, you should have a nice mix, which will not produce smell. So in an aerated system like this one, the worms are doing the aeration for you.
Mm-hmm.
In an aerated system, you should not have any unpleasant odors.
Okay.
It's typically only in an anaerobic environment that you will have foul odors because of the bacteria that are involved in anaerobic processes.
Okay.
Yeah, and so they're producing... This is basically all worm poo.
Yeah.
Right?
Awesome. Yeah, so this is huge compared to the thing I have at home. But it's really good to see. Like, this is what a successful worm bin looks like.
So if you want to keep fruit flies away for sure, what I would do is bury it into the actual substrate itself.
Okay.
And then you can put your bedding on top.
Cool.
Yeah.
I was now armed with tips on how to keep a healthy worm bin. But could I convince my sister of this as well? A week later, it was time to feed the worms, and I volunteered my sister for the job to see if I could change her mind.
It's been a week since we got our worm compost, so come on over, Jillian. I've got a liter of food for this week, so if you want to come on over here.
This is an appropriate distance.
No, you need to come towards the compost. Yeah, there we go. Okay. So, can you describe what you're seeing right now? You haven't actually opened the box yet.
An ugly-ass box sitting in the middle of our living room with
a suspiciously happy-looking worm sticker on the side.
Interesting. Okay, that's a good first impression. So I noticed right away you're plugging your nose. You're expecting... No, this is really interesting. So I haven't even opened the lid, and right now you're already covering your nose, and you're expecting it to really smell.
I don't want to look at them.
So, what is, when I open the box, what do you expect to see?
It's massive worms just kind of wriggling around.
Okay. All right, let's open the box.
Don't do it.
Let's open the box.
I don't want to look at
it. So, let's...
Where are the worms? Oh, it smells! It smells like farm...
You first said something, though, when I opened the box. What did you say?
Where are the worms?
Right. Interesting. So not at all what you were expecting.
Have they escaped? Are they in my bed? Why are you touching it? Shouldn't you wear gloves?
No, it's fine. What else can you smell?
It's not unpleasant.
Is earthy a good way to describe it? Like, it smells like...
I guess so.
Like a forest, maybe?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not actually that bad.
There was a lot more food when I initially...
What is that?
That's lettuce. Do you see this hole? That was not there when I... Like, this has been definitely well eaten.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like, this was quite full. There's holes... And see... Do you see all those black things on there?
Yeah, what is that?
Those are worm castings, so that's called...
Poo? That's worm poo. That's a nice, science-y way of saying worm poo.
Have you seen a worm yet?
Yeah, where are they? That does smell like a forest.
I know no one can see this right now, but she's actually touching the bedding.
Don't know you found one. Yeah. I hate how they move so much. It's looking for prey.
So, now that we've seen the compost, what are your thoughts? This is our first week in.
And I guess it doesn't smell the way I thought it would. That does not to say that I enjoy the smell. The rotten food still throws me off a little bit.
Do you still think that this is the worst idea I've ever had?
Well, it's not the best idea you've ever had, but it's not the worst either, I guess.
Progress. We are making progress. We are changing attitudes. So how afraid are you of worm attacks after this meeting?
I guess not as afraid. Get that smirk off your face.
There's no smirk. This is just, like, really cool that I didn't actually expect that you'd be as... interested in this as you are right now. And you even touched the bedding, which is a very cool thing.
This won't be an ongoing thing. This is your project still.
Yeah. It's just you're a little bit more accepting of it now.
I guess.
Almost 2 weeks later, and the worm bin is still doing well. And my sister has helped me check on it once more. In less than 2 years, Metro Vancouver will be implementing their ban on organic waste. And part of me wonders how many people would be more open to it if they knew that compost can be well managed and easily taken care of. The vermicomposting workshop I took was completely full, so hopefully that is a clear sign that attitudes are beginning to change. Either way, I've managed to partially change my sister's attitude, which I mark down as a huge accomplishment. Reporting for LFS 400, I'm Nicole Reed. Thanks for listening.
What was the thing that your mother told you as a child to guilt you into finishing your broccoli at dinner? For me, it was, "Eat your vegetables. People are starving in Africa." This simple sentence always made me feel guilty, but it also distanced me from the problem of food insecurity. To me, it was always happening somewhere else. I've since learned that just having food does not make you food secure. In order to be food secure, you need to have access to enough nutritious food to maintain a healthy lifestyle. Here in Vancouver, people often can't afford to buy healthy food. For them, food insecurity is not a problem in some far-off place. So, eat up your vegetables, kids. People are starving next door.
My food, oh, it's here and in the freezer. So here I've got turkey. I think there's only one Safeway that sells turkey chili. And then I've got some cream of mushroom soup and some jam.
This is Dory. She faces food insecurity every day as a local senior. For the past 3 years, I've been Dory's student support worker. One of the main things that I do for her is shop for her groceries. When I buy my own groceries, my privilege allows for me to purchase some of the best food that Vancouver has to offer. I always buy local, organic foods that are grown without pesticides. But when I shop for Dory, I have to buy her things that I would never buy for myself. Microwave dinners and processed food are some of the main items on her shopping lists, and the primary reason for this is the high cost of food.
What is your main concern when you go out and buy food or get somebody to buy food for you?
Well, it actually depends if I'm buying food or someone else is buying food. It's harder if I'm buying food because the first thing I look at is price. You know, you just present me with the bill, right? Whereas I'm not feeling the knife going in me with every box I pick up, right?
Dory would like to buy healthy food, but it's just not in her budget.
How important would you say buying organic is to you?
It's really important to me, but so is living within my income.
An added challenge for Dory is her lack of energy. Because of this, she has a hard time getting out to buy the food that she needs.
I mean, just getting food is, when you can't go out, is hard. I couldn't worry about quality.
These challenges make it difficult for Dory to find her next meal. As she gets older, these problems have only gotten worse. Living on a tight budget with limited energy has really restricted her choices.
Seniors or people with disabilities, people who can't, who don't have much of an income and who can't get out are just not valued in the society. So it's, you know, oh, that'll satisfy them. Not much money is given to places that try to help us out because it's not considered important.
Dory is one senior facing food insecurity on a daily basis, but she is not alone in her struggles. Countless Vancouver seniors remain invisible every day as they try to find their next meal. I decided to see what was being done to fix this problem in my city. So, I visited an organization that has been fighting food insecurity in the Vancouver seniors community for 47 years. Meals on Wheels is a meal delivery service run by the Health and Home Care Society of BC. Every weekday, Meals on Wheels volunteers deliver over 400 meals to isolated, homebound people living in Vancouver and Richmond. One of these people is Dory.
Part of our role here at Meals on Wheels is to be that link in the chain that's providing an overall system of care.
This is Suzanne Little, the volunteer program manager for Meals on Wheels. We met recently to talk about Dory's struggles and food insecurity in general.
There is a wider issue with food insecurity and food justice. People who do have limited access to shopping or choices concerning their own food tend to get the raw end of the deal. They tend to be given processed stuff and convenience foods and things like that that will just put something in their stomach but are not necessarily good for them, good for their health, good for the world. And I think that that's a major issue.
Meals on Wheels is a big part of dealing with this issue, but providing food isn't enough to ensure food security. So I asked Suzanne about the nutritional standards of the organization's meals. Are they able to provide Vancouver seniors with the food they need to live a healthy lifestyle?
We just try and keep it really balanced, as low fat as possible, but also making it tasty. You know, we still want them to enjoy their food, obviously.
It's difficult for Meals on Wheels to find the balance between being tasty, nutritious, and affordable. Currently, Meals on Wheels charges $6 a meal, even though it costs about $8 to get the meal to the clients. I asked Suzanne about the possibility of getting quality local organic products into the organization's meals.
Well, that's something that we would love to provide. You know, it's all a cost issue for us. A lot of our clients are lower income, so it's a cost issue for them as well. So we're trying to provide the best service that we can, giving value for money.
Cost stands in the way of Dory and other Vancouver seniors getting quality local organic products that are good for them and good for the world. I decided to talk to a Vancouver company that is growing this type of food within the city to see why their produce is so inaccessible to people like Dory.
It's one of our older sites and one of our most well-maintained sites. The landowners are really involved with this.
This is Inner City Farms. Inner City Farms, or ICF, is a Vancouver company that produces local, organic, sustainably grown food in residential green spaces throughout the city. I visited one of their gardens to talk to two members of the company's management team. Camille Dumont is the head farmer at Inner City Farms.
Vancouver is one of the most expensive places to live in the world. And as a result, it's really expensive to do everything, including eat. So there are lots of people here that don't have enough money to eat, probably to the health standards that would benefit them most.
Ahmed Amlani, an associate farmer with the company, understands how their prices can be a barrier.
Food that is fresh and healthy and grown in a way that doesn't wreck the planet shouldn't be a privilege.
Inner City Farms sells their products through community-supported agriculture shares, or CSAs. Last season, an Inner City Farms CSA cost $600. For this price, shareholders got around $30 worth of vegetables each week from June until October. I asked Camille and Ahmed to walk me through their pricing process for the CSAs.
We're an incorporated business, so all of our money comes directly from the sale of our vegetables. So we basically charge what we have to charge in order to afford the project.
With only one paid employee, Inner City Farms is run almost entirely by dedicated volunteers.
We'd love to pay them all as much money as possible because we think their time is valuable and worth it, but then a CSA would cost $1,000 instead of what it costs now.
We're not even right now charging the true cost of what it would actually cost to grow all this food.
Not even close. It's often quite striking to see how many people work to make our vegetables come to reality and how expensive they would be if we incorporated all the true costs, particularly labor costs, into what we'd have to charge people.
Is there a typical ICF customer?
It's probably middle upper class families. I mean, the criticism that food grown like this is inaccessible to people who are of low income brackets is absolutely valid. Asking the urban farmers to shoulder the entirety of the responsibility for that really tells only one slice of the story.
Inner City Farms is not the bad guy in this story. They're a small Vancouver business working to make a positive change by growing healthy, sustainable food in people's front yards. Real Food for Change is the company's latest project. It aims to get local businesses involved in sponsoring urban farm plots. These plots would then be used to grow food for those who couldn't otherwise afford it.
Honestly, delicious, healthy food should be free. So until we get that, there's lots of work to do.
So, Dory was right when she said that the problem of food insecurity in Vancouver is a real issue. However, after visiting Meals on Wheels and Inner City Farms, I realized that there are local organizations that value low-income Vancouverites. These organizations are working hard to make sure that people like Dory are getting healthy, delicious food every day. I talked to Dory about the Real Food for Change initiative to get her thoughts on the project.
I mean, I just think it would be wonderful. Or an urban garden contributing to Meals on Wheels. It makes such a difference to me when they have actual cooked vegetables for our meal. It just makes a huge difference.
For now, I'll keep buying Dory the food that she can afford rather than the food that is best for her. But we're both excited about the fact that change is happening. Until that change comes, eat your vegetables, kids. Reporting for LFS 400 Radio, I'm Jillian Reed.
When I grow up, I want to be a hockey player,
an artist, and a singer.
I would like to be a ballet dancer,
an engineer,
a veterinarian,
pilot.
I want to be a professional athlete,
a soldier.
When I grow up, I want to be a policeman,
a violin maker.
I want to be a marine biologist.
I want to be a doctor,
a princess.
We tell kids to dream big about what they will be when they grow up. The sky is the limit, we tell them, but this isn't exactly what we mean. We encourage kids who want to be doctors or lawyers. We humor those that want to be ballerinas or garbage men, hoping they'll grow out of it sooner or later. I'm a few short weeks away from graduating. Every day I'm asked, "So what are you going to do when you're done?" When I reply, I get the same reaction as the kid who wants to be a G.I. Joe. We don't like to say it out loud, but our culture says that some jobs are better than others. Most see success as the balancing act of making a lot of money and being able to take time off. Enjoying your job is more of a bonus than a requirement. I feel sheepish telling people I want to be a farmer. People view farming as something that's only inherited for the pushover sibling that gets stuck with the family business. Emmy's an urban farmer in Vancouver, and she struggled with how people view farming.
A huge challenge is kind of how farming is perceived, in the sense that, like, my family, they're like, I was supposed to be a doctor, and then I said I was going to be a teacher, and they were okay with that. But it's not a profession that you grow up in an educated system believing is a noble profession, and it's hard because you want some, like, my entire life I've been working towards being that good person, you know, and seeking the approval of society, and now I'm doing something that is strange or not as respected, and it's hard.
So with no family history in agriculture and a university education, why, for Pete's sake, would Emmy or I deliberately choose to farm? I started university 5 years ago with no idea of what I wanted to be when I grew up. I started learning about natural sciences and eventually focused on our food system. I've come to believe that the way we make and distribute food is pretty destructive to people and the rest of the planet. Lucky for us, there are people who have good ideas about how to change this situation, about how to grow food in a way that benefits people and doesn't destroy the place that sustains us. Kent Mullenix is one of these people. He shared some of these good ideas with me over a cup of coffee. He's a professor at Kwantlen Polytechnic University. For him, the future of agriculture looks very different.
We can't continue producing our food in the ways that we have come to produce our food the last 50, 70 years because it's incredibly destructive.
The world is quickly running out of fossil fuels. Farming will have to become a human-intensive endeavor once again.
We need people in agriculture. We absolutely have to. The 1.5% of our population that's engaged in industrial farming now is going to have to expand to 20% of our population. Good farming and ecologically sound farming is an incredibly knowledge-intensive and skill-intensive endeavor. And we absolutely need to be teaching young people how to farm.
But there's a huge gap between our industrial system and the human-powered agriculture that Kent dreams of. In order to make this real,
we need young people who are willing to say, enough, this is not right, and I have a better idea of what is right, of what is a right way to live, what is a right way to farm, what is a right way to eat, what is a right way to relate to one another, what is a right way to relate to Mother Earth. You gotta stand up and be proud. That's what I think.
And there are young people, like me, like Emmy, that want to bring this ideal to reality. As an urban farmer, Emmy grows vegetables and raises chickens on people's yards in Vancouver. And without preaching or telling people what they're doing is wrong, she makes healthy and local food a reality for people around her.
I've heard this quote, I think. I started off trying to save the world, and in the end, I became a farmer. I think that's what is the magic of being a farmer, is that you can't influence everything that happens on a global scale, but it feels wonderful to have your hands in the soil and to be cultivating a change, like, happening every single moment. It's so cool.
But how does this new vision of farming fit with existing farmers? How do they see their work in the world? What keeps a farmer going year after year?
We can walk through here. A little door right here.
Jack has farmed for over 50 years on Westham Island in Delta. You can see that his gumboots have tread many miles over his farm, and his sun-bleached cap has seen many long seasons. He grows seed potatoes mostly, and has beans and peas and a few head of cattle. He learned to farm from his father, who learned to farm from his father before him. For Jack, there was no other career.
But I didn't really think about it a lot. It's just, as a kid, you wind up with jobs on the farm. And so I farmed since I got out of school, and really haven't done anything else.
He enjoys the cycling of the seasons and the variability of every day.
I like to go out and see what's going on. I don't commute to work. I walk down the road. I open the door and say, oh yeah, there's something I gotta do. And that's how my day begins. And there's a lot of different things you have to do as a farmer. I mean, you have to be strong and lift hay bales, move boxes, and you have to be skilled as a mechanic or a builder. I got a few cows, so you wind up doing some veterinary stuff. You're a bookkeeper? I think I'm a jack of all trades. I can do lots of different things. But the funny thing is,